You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
Welcome to the ECF staff room. I'm Elaine Long.
And I am Mark Quinn.
We are programme leaders for the UCL Early Career Teacher Development Programme. Why are we in the staff room? We are here because this is where the best professional learning conversations always take place. This is where problems can be aired bluntly and where solutions can be explored.
Over the course of this series, we will hear the voices of different colleagues as they come into the ECF staff room. We will hear from early career teachers themselves and from the mentors and induction tutors who support them. We will talk about all things ECF, the challenges and the joys. So why don't you enjoy a coffee with us, perhaps even grab a biscuit and sit down to half an hour of ECF staff room chat. Welcome to the ECF staff room, Stephanie.
Do take
the weight off your feet. Have a seat. I'm going to make you a coffee. How do you take your coffee?
Oh, I'm quite picky about coffee. I have my coffee black, no sugar. Yeah, that'll do.
Strong, weak, with a bit of extra water or not?
Oh, no, strong and no cold water on the top.
Perfect. Exactly how I have mine as well. Just out of interest, when you were in school, what did the children call you in school?
They either called me Mrs. Bingham if I was winning or Miss if I wasn't winning.
And so you would know if you were winning, if you weren't.
Oh, well, it's just a bit lazy, isn't it, to call everybody Miss? I don't think it's difficult to give people a name. So,
yeah.
But it was a repeated message that didn't come across particularly well, really. It didn't, because everybody, even some of the staff, called you Miss. And I've never really liked that.
No.
I'm just a bit old fashioned.
Yeah, no, I take your point. Although being shouted sir across the street on a Saturday afternoon is a bit strange as well.
It is, yes. Yeah.
So Stephanie, I'd like to tell us a little bit about your current role, what you're doing now, and basically what have you been up to today?
Okay, so my current role is I'm the Programme Director at NETSBE, which is based in the Education Leadership Centre at Newcastle University. And my role is to lead on programme development and programme delivery for the Early Career Framework and for NPQs for schools across the North East. And today I've done a bit of firefighting, which I probably won't share with you. Didn't bring me an awful lot of joy. And I've been in a meeting with the DfE, and I've been in a meeting to discuss NPQ content. And I've also been doing some QA of some NPQ materials that we're writing. And I've also been fielding a significantly large number of emails.
Well, maybe it'll help if I whisk you away from that to thinking a little bit further backwards, because we know you've had a long and fabulous career in education. So could you tell us a bit about your starting point and then how it led to where you are now?
Yeah, I did a history degree and just was totally in love with history and wanted to share with as many people as I possibly could. So I became a teacher and I spent about 23 years in teaching and different leadership roles in schools in the Northeast. And then I began doing some leadership development work and left teaching to work with teachers to develop teaching practice. I did that in 2014, I think. And as part of that, I became a facilitator on the NPQ programmes with NETSBE. And that's how I became the programme director at NETSBE. But I did various bits of work on Teesside in particular, and we conducted some research projects, and I was involved in the Transforming Tees project, and I was involved in the Hartlepool Education Commission. So I did quite a lot of really interesting things when I came out of school at the starting point that have led to where I am now. But I definitely moved from the classroom teaching role to a sort of a leadership development role and working with teachers.
And what do you enjoy most about your current role, apart from fielding lots of emails?
That's the bit I don't love. What I really love is meeting people that work in lots and lots of different educational settings, and that I've learned lots of things that I wish I'd known while I was still teaching, because I work cross phase and I work cross institutions. The education landscape has changed a great deal since I left teaching, even, never mind since I started. And so multi-academy trusts have totally changed the way education's working in the Northeast and across the country as well. So I enjoy the networking and the partnership and the learning that I'm doing. But I also really enjoy the professional development side of work. I like watching a teacher's professional development journey. I like seeing the impact that the programs that we run can have on somebody's professional journey. I love seeing those eureka moments where they say, oh, now I know how I'm going to do something. It's really powerful and important, and it plugs a bit of that gap that teaching's such a purposeful job, isn't it? And you're so aware that you're contributing to somebody's life journey and that you're doing something of value for the nation. And when you stop teaching, there's quite a big bereavement involved in that, I think, about, well, who am I? What's my identity and what's my purpose in my professional life? And developing teachers and helping teachers to learn, and also reaching a stage where you think, actually, I have got quite a bit of expertise myself that I can share, but I also know lots of other people that have got expertise that can plug the gaps that I've got. It's intellectually interesting, but it also still feels purposeful, and it feels as if I'm still contributing to the education world. So I think that's what I really love.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned as well that you'd learned things that you wish you'd known when you were teaching. So I just wonder if you could take some of those things you've learned and go back to that younger teacher that you were, what would you tell that younger teacher knowing what you know now?
Well, I worked with teenagers. So I think I would tell my younger self, go and learn how to teach English and reading to children who aren't very literate and didn't grow up with books, because you could have fixed a lot of problems in the classroom when children couldn't access the curriculum, really, because they weren't literate. And I think it took me a really long time to understand that that's what was going on, and I definitely didn't have the skill set to fix it. And schools are stretched and they don't always pick it up in secondary schools. I don't think there are very many people in secondary schools who really know how to teach young people to read. I think that's a massive gap in our professional development. And so I would do that. I would also tell myself to form stronger relationships with families if I possibly could, because I think that dialogue, I think I know much more now, particularly from the work that I've done with primary schools who pick children up right at the beginning of their educational life. I think I know much more now about how important those early years are, those formative years, and how intimidated a lot of people are by secondary schools and by coming in and speaking to secondary school teachers. And I don't think I navigated that particularly well. Even as a head of faculty, I don't think I navigated that particularly well. I was winging it. I worked on instinct. I'm a good communicator, but I lacked a lot of knowledge that would have helped me to kind of make a better connection between family and student as a threesome and work out how we could fix educational problems. So those are two things that I would tell my younger self. There are quite a lot of others, but we've got limited time. It's break time.
I would share both of those as well, I think.
Would you?
I think, yeah, that, well, I am an English teacher and I led literacy across the school for quite a while. So the fact that teachers need to conceive themselves as teachers of literacy as well as their subject in secondary school is often a more alien concept. And also the gap in knowledge and expertise around how children acquire those skills definitely needs plugging. And I think, you know, we often talk about teaching as a cognitive act, but you really raise the importance of teaching being a social and emotional act as well.
Yeah, it really is.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because relationships with other colleagues, relationships with parents and carers, teachers as teachers of literacy. I mean, that's been that language has been in our profession for 40 years and more.
And
it might be that we've not made the progress in those areas that we really might have done or we should have done.
Yeah.
And of course, it leads me to the topic of this discussion today, which is about the early career framework, because of course that's the latest attempt, I suppose, to try to address those gaps in teacher preparedness for the job. And you know, and those two things again do feature in the early career framework. I guess it might be for others to decide whether it's adequately covered in the framework or whether our program does an adequate job for preparing teachers in those ways. But we certainly hope, don't we, that in those two areas and in others, that we are doing our best to prepare teachers. You've got vast experience, Stephanie, for such a young person, and worked in so many schools and have such relationships with so many schools in the northeast of the country. And of course, we got to know you principally through the early rollout of this program. So you'll have seen how the Early Career Framework program has been implemented in schools. So really, really interested to know from your perspective what you would see as the main challenges for schools in implementing this program.
Well, you're not going to be surprised that the first challenge, I think, is time. This is a very content-rich program, and it's quite difficult for any teacher to take on extra learning when they're trying to deliver the learning for young people in their schools. And so doing the reading and addressing the tasks that lie within the early career framework, I think it's hard to do that. And I think it's hard for the mentors to provide the time that they need to provide to give their early career teacher the level of support that they need. So I think that's a really big challenge, and that's a challenge for schools. That should be a challenge for schools rather than just for individuals, I think. And I think the other challenge that we've had from feedback from schools, from mentors and induction tutors and early career teachers, is that the framework is quite a prescriptive framework, and the statements are quite prescriptive for a reason. They're evidence-based. This is what we know makes good practice. But when you start teaching, do you remember that frightening time when you first start teaching? You suddenly think, oh, I've got to carry on regardless. This is my timetable and my set of classes, and I've just got to do it. Actually, we all emerge with particular strengths and particular areas for development. And if you're following a program that's got quite a tight sequence, but the bit that addresses your particular area for development, which might be quite urgent, is in module 4, and you need to deal with it now. Actually, particularly because it's quite a tight sequence, people don't really feel free to amend the sequence and jump forward or jump backwards. And I think as we go forward, we need to learn how to send the message that you can be flexible about it. Because if my problem is classroom management, then the fact that we're in the week looking at questioning, clearly there's a link between effective questioning and good behaviour management. Yeah. But actually, if Johnny won't sit down, I need to learn the techniques to make sure that I manage that situation properly. And questioning is probably not part of it, not immediately. And so I think those two challenges, having enough time to get the best out of the programme for the mentor and for the early career teacher, and being able to meet the needs of a really new teacher whilst also being faithful to the programme, I think it's two quite big challenges. And they match each other as well, don't they? Because the time that you've set aside for your mentor meeting for the early career teacher might get swallowed up by today's crisis that you've actually got to fix. And so those two things might actually kind of collide with each other and become even bigger as a result of clashing.
Yeah, totally. And I would say, you know, obviously we listen to our mentors and our early career teachers frequently through the program. And those two things, amongst others, but those two things do come, you know, they shout that at us, you know, loud and clear. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd love to do this program, but I'd need a bit more time to get the best out of it. Mm-hmm. And also this idea, but sort of personalizing it. Am I allowed to personalize the program? I'm hoping you've also seen schools that have addressed these problems quite well. I mean, if you got solutions to these challenges that you've just raised for us, Stephanie?
Well, I've got one particularly good solution, which was a school which decided that for logistical reasons, it was a big secondary school, and what they decided was that all of the early career teachers would have a subject mentor, and the subject mentor was following the school's induction program and the subjects areas for development, and teaching that teacher and supporting that teacher in their professional journey that's subject specific. How do you teach science? How do you teach maths? What do I do when this happens in English? And the induction tutor used the mentor time for the early career teacher, the early career framework, sorry, to work with them as a group. So they actually had two sets of mentoring in the week, but because they were on a lighter timetable, there was time for that. And they worked as a group on the early career framework and individually in their subject areas. And that actually worked really well for all of them. Now, I think that tells you quite a lot about the culture in the school, that they've obviously got quite a nimble leadership team who've thought carefully about, well, how can we make sure that we're going to follow both programs? And that was part of the early career framework, the early rollout. So it was quite quick that they looked at it and thought, right, this is too big. But on the other hand, this was a school that was volunteering to take part in a new program that wasn't statutory. So they were already in the mindset that, yeah, okay, let's see what we can do with this. They felt like they had the capacity. And those early career teachers talked strongly about how much they valued having those group sessions, because the discussion was rich. The person who was leading it, the induction tutor, was more experienced in most cases than their subject mentor was. They were further into their career. They had more understanding of what it was like to be an early career teacher. And so they felt as if they were getting the best of both worlds, because they were getting subject specific wisdom from a subject specialist, but they were getting that overarching kind of generic professional development thinking from a really highly experienced member of the senior leadership team. So, but that was time efficient as well, because it meant that the mentors weren't trying to deal with subject specific mentoring and also the early career framework mentoring, and then just basically giving up twice as much time to run it.
So I guess this is an induction tutor who must know the program really well, if they're able to, you know, select the parts of it which they can lead communally. That sounds like part of the message that school has absorbed. You know, knowing the structure of the program really well means that you can intervene with it, you can dip in and dip out, you can work out the bits that are going to sit well across your school, I suppose. It comes down to leadership, I suppose.
It comes down to leadership, and it comes down to preparation and good communication. And so that person contacted us and talked to us about the issue they'd got in the school and posed it as a suggestion. Is this a good solution? And they asked us about the content of the programme. And so we were able to talk to them about the audits, for example. Mm-hmm. And so the audits are a good way to identify where the areas for development are, and to then maybe do paired work with people that have got the same issues, or paired work with people that have got a strength and a weakness that oppose each other, so that they can support each other in their development. Oh, well, I do this, because that's good to learn and to feel like an expert right at the beginning of your career, to think, oh, that's not my problem, actually, I can do that, and this is how I do it. Sometimes that's easier to receive. So that was part of it, that we did have discussions with them, but I don't want to take very much credit for it, because it was their solution in the first place, and they came with very specific questions. One of the things that I noticed about that school, and a piece of advice that I would definitely give to induction tutors, is to be really familiar with the handbook and think in advance about what you already do in your school. Because one of the time problems that came up in the early rollout was that high performing schools who have very good induction processes tried to run that as well as the early career framework, and that doesn't work, and it's not wise to do that. And there are ways that you can make sure that you cover the essential things from your own school's provision that you definitely don't want to drop. Yeah. And other places where you can recognise that some of your own school's provision is actually mirrored in the early career framework, and you could probably drop it because the early career framework will cover it anyway. And that's about leadership again, isn't it? But it's also about being well informed and thinking it through in advance. So I think picking it up in September and starting to think about it in September is not not good practice. I wouldn't do that. I mean, I appreciate that you might have to do that if you take on a new teacher right at the beginning of the year, having not expected to. Sure. But if you know in advance that you're going to have early career teachers starting the school year in September, I would say get yourself reading that framework, and get yourself reading the handbook, and think about the programme materials and what you already do and what you can take out. Because we had lots of comments about it's absolutely hopeless. I can't possibly go to all of the school CPD and then all of the early career framework. And that's not what you're being asked to do.
Yeah.
And if you are being asked to do that, then the school hasn't quite thought through what the implications are for you. So I think, yeah, you're right. It is about leadership, and it's about the leadership team properly understanding what's involved and properly thinking about how it fits in with what they already do and adapting what they expect both mentors and early career teachers to do. Because actually, for a mentor, if you've asked a mentor to take on that responsibility, then to expect them also to go to all of your internal professional development when reading through the materials on the early career framework is actually quite a rich bit of professional development for a mentor anyway. Mm-hmm. And it includes mentor professional development for mentors. Those training sessions are not, this is how you do the early career framework. It's, let's help you to develop in your mentoring journey. This is some investment in you. And schools need to recognise that as well. And I think there are times when perhaps they could free the mentors up from some of the internal CPD and let them have their own pathway, which is, I am developing as a mentor. This is what my professional development priority is for this academic year. And so when I'm going to an ECF session, or when I'm running a mentor meeting with my trainee or my early career teacher, actually that means I don't need to be going to the school CPD, because that's too generic. And actually this is my professional learning journey.
Yeah, I know that Elaine's got a question about this coming up. Elaine?
Yeah, I was just going to add to what you were saying about giving people license to focus solely on mentoring. And I think there's something around that, around the value people place on mentoring and the fact that we undervalue it in schools as a professional development route, and we undervalue the importance of it in schools as well. And I wonder if that's why people don't do that so much, because they have that misconception around that. But I wanted to move away from the in-school activities of the ECF to the facilitated sessions. And okay, you're in the privileged position that you will have seen lots of facilitated sessions.
I have.
For the ECF. And you also would have been involved in helping to train facilitators and mm-hmm. structure those sessions into different cluster groups. And I just wanted you to think about those three things, really: working with facilitators to develop them, structuring the sessions in terms of different clusters, and also the actual delivery of the sessions. And thinking about those three things, what have you learned about what makes high quality professional development for all in those sessions?
Really strong preparation is important. It's not a thing that you can busk, and it's really important that you come prepared. And that's not just in the sense of preparing the materials that are provided for you, but it's also, I think, the best facilitators that I've seen have also reflected on their own practice and how could I illustrate this point with something from my own practice. And because we're delivering the early career framework in phase specific groups, the facilitators should be able to provide an illustration of the good practice or of the statements and illustrating what the research says through really visceral examples. Actually, they should be able to make it really come alive. And so from the point of view of training the facilitators, it's important that they feel empowered to do that, and that we're really clear with them that there are some scripted materials here, but the script is there so that you don't feel like you've got to prepare a whole session from scratch. It is not there like a play where you've got to learn it and deliver it. It's not a performance. This is, in a sense, this is your guide. And if you think that there's something better that you could put in as a scenario, or if you think there are better questions, provided you're faithful to the framework and faithful to the intent of the session so that the learning outcome remains the same, then play with it and put it in. So the last session that I QA'd, there were two facilitators who worked in different schools that were in the same mat, and they had got to know each other through facilitation. So That's another thing that I would say, is that facilitation is an opportunity to develop your own professional network and to learn about practice in other schools. And I know that professional relationships have grown as a result of our facilitation pairings. But one of the things that they had done that really struck me was that they had done their preparation jointly. So they both read all the materials, and then they'd got together and they'd shared the anecdotes and the illustrations that they thought would make the session work. And so when they did the facilitation, it was really clear to the participants that they had a strong relationship. So it was, it felt warm and it felt very professional, because it was quite clear that quite a rich professional conversation had gone on between these facilitators beforehand. So there was good modeling going on there. You know, we're at this stage in our career, but we're still learning, we're still sharing, we're still learning from each other. But also, we don't turn up and busk. We prepare this. We care about your learning journey. And so we've made an effort about how we're going to present it. And I think they were able to do that partly because we had made them free to do that. We had made it really clear. Pepper it with your own experience. If that scenario is not the right scenario, and it does say that in all the guidance, but I think when you've got a set of slides that have all been nicely prepared, you think, well, I don't think I can change that. No, change them. I mean, obviously keep the colour scheme and the logos, very important, but having stayed faithful to our design and our brand, please put your own scenarios in there if they're better illustrations of the, because you know the context of the schools that you're working with as well as a facilitator, and they get to know it by the middle of year two. They know those participants really well, and they know all the little things that have been coming up through the school year, and they've picked up bits and pieces about how the schools are structured and what the hierarchies are and what the modus operandi are. And so it's really important to use that in your facilitation, and the best facilitation definitely does that.
And have you seen any differences in the quality of the sessions between year one and year two?
I think I've seen the facilitators feel much more comfortable and much less nervous. I think they were very nervous about making sure teachers want to do a good job, don't they? And we're not very comfortable teaching to somebody else's lesson plan. And so at the beginning, I think people were really slightly overawed maybe by the materials, and there was a lot to cover, and how do I cover all of this, and what if there's a really rich discussion, that means I haven't got time for slide four, how do I deal with that? So they're much more comfortable now because they've learned, and I'm quite a pragmatic person, and I mean, Mark, you and I have been in meetings with the DfE right at the very early stages where we've said, can you really cover that number of statements across an academic year, is that really what you want to do? Oh yes, that's what we want to do. But I think you have to be pragmatic and say, look, this is a really good tool for improving professional development in schools. This is a really good way to enrich new teachers' knowledge and understanding of what works in the classroom. And if you miss a bit, I don't know how much that's going to matter in the long scheme of things, because the most important thing is that they are engaging with thinking, and they are really clearly aware that there's an evidence base that will tell you how to fix issues in your classroom, and that will tell you how to plan curricula, and that will tell you how to assess effectively. And so for the facilitators to be able to say, right, I ran a session in year one and I missed out a bit of it because I really couldn't fit it all in, and we had quite a good breakout session. And actually in the long run, it didn't matter because they had learnt it. And they had learnt the intent, and in the plenary discussion, it was clear they understood what was going on. Now they feel more at ease. So I think I've definitely seen that. I've definitely seen people going on a confidence journey and a sort of a proficiency journey. And they're all familiar with the framework as well. I mean, that's another thing, isn't it?
I think familiarity with the framework is something that's actually hugely underestimated, and the time it takes to develop that expertise in the framework and within sessions to go backwards and forwards and link to different parts of it. I think that's hugely underrated. And I think also I totally agree with you, this idea of fidelity versus variation and the contextualization. I think that's something that's incredibly difficult as well. And it can feel quite scary because people know they've got to be faithful to the framework. So it might feel a bit safer almost to treat it like a script, as you said. But if people do that, our ECTs are going to go away not feeling like they've had an experience that really talks to them.
Yeah, and we also, you know, want the facilitators to take advantage of the experience they have. You know, we didn't just pluck them off the street. You knew some of these people from your own past experiences as a facilitator. You've worked with these people over many years, many of them. And that's the case across the program. You know, these facilitators have been selected for very good reasons.
Yeah.
They're excellent practitioners in the classroom. Most of them are still in the classroom.
Yeah.
And so we would want them them to draw upon that kind of rich well of experience and expertise that they have without overwhelming these poor new teachers with everything they should be able to do by now.
But actually, one of the things that's richest about the anecdotes that they have or the illustrations that they use is that they don't sell themselves as being absolutely excellent. They talk about a problem they've encountered and how they've resolved it. And so that's actually really reassuring for an early career teacher, that even somebody who's 10 or 15 years into their teaching life is still dealing with issues in the classroom, or they're planning things that then it just doesn't work. And they think, oh, I spent hours planning that and it hasn't worked. This happens. And it doesn't mean that you're not very good at your job. You're not very good at your job if you don't recognize it and you don't fix it. But if something doesn't go very well in the classroom, well, that might have been because there were 30 people in there. You know, things don't always work. I mean, who's perfect all the time? I don't want to work with them. So, well, do you? I mean, really. So you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think one of the things that our facilitators have really benefited from is that when we gave the brief to the delivery partners about selection for facilitators, we were really clear that although facilitating is a very rich professional development opportunity for the facilitators, and they should bear that in mind, who's ready for that learning and who's ready to give that time and that thought, we also made it really clear that it wasn't appropriate to pick your very talented eager beaver who's 3 years in, because they won't have credibility in the session. Not because they're not talented and not because they're not good, but because they haven't been around the block often enough. And you need that thing about continuity and the fact that if you're in a secondary school, that you've taken people from year 7 to year 11, or that if you're in a primary school, you've seen that what you do in year 2, the impact that has in year 5 if you haven't done it very well. You need people that really understand the sequence of the school curriculum and understand how different teaching can be at different phases or different key stages or in different areas of the curriculum. And you can't do that if you haven't been doing it very long. It doesn't matter if you started teaching when you were 40 or started teaching when you're 23. If you've only been doing it for 3 years, you don't have enough knowledge about how to fix the issues and about curriculum sequence that will give you the credibility to really develop your early career teachers. And I think the same is true. The same is even more true for mentors. You know, some of our mentors are head teachers. So however talented one of your new mentors may be, they are not the people to run to be facilitating, because they need to be able to chair a conversation between very experienced professionals with credibility. And that can't be done if you don't really have the experience to pick it all up and illustrate it yourself.
And it's one of the things that I love about the CCF program is that, you know, obviously it's about early career teachers and it's about their mentors, and many mentors will have a few years experience, maybe not very experienced. That, you know, you become a mentor from various different routes, you know, and you should be glad that you become a mentor. Your head teacher has, you know, tapped you on the shoulder, but it can be very experienced or quite inexperienced. Mm-hmm. But facilitators are not, they are a different class altogether, aren't they? And I love the fact that we found a way of valuing those colleagues who have been round the block a few times and have trimmed a few hedges and, you know, and actually by now know what they don't know, you know, and can share that. As you say, it's not an anecdote. It's a kind of dilemma-based facilitation, which I think is a wonderful thing. And we've got, you know, and it's great that we've found, you know, that a space has been found for that kind of expertise within the profession.
Yeah. I think to return to something else you said as well, Stephanie, about facilitators modelling the fact that they still get things wrong, that even after so many years, they're still learning. I think that's really important, because I see a link between that and challenging this idea that the framework is a repeat, that we hear so much from ECTs. This is a repeat. I've already done it. And I think it's really important, therefore, that facilitators do keep reminding them that actually you come back to the teaching standards throughout your whole career. You know, I was a teacher for 20 years. I would never say I mastered it at all, ever. So I think that modelling and that sense of, you know, you constantly do revisit the same themes in teaching, and hopefully you learn each time and get better. It is really important as well, and that facilitators are actually role models, you know, in many ways for ECTs. Moving on, to almost the end of the podcast, sadly, because I'm so enjoying talking to you. But we give every guest on our podcast a post-it note. So I'm just going to pass you a post-it note over now. It's a lovely luminous yellow one.
Thank you. Luckily, I have a pen.
Great. You've come prepared. Good. You're not that teacher that comes to the session without a pen. I'm pleased to know that. And what we would like you to do on your post-it note is we would like you to write a piece of advice, and that can be a piece of advice for anyone you choose. So it could be for us at UCL, it could be for your younger self, it could be for a mentor, a facilitator, anyone you like. So we would like you to tell us what advice you've written on your luminous yellow post-it note and who you would like to give that post-it note to.
So I would like to give my post-it note to the induction tutors in school, and it says, make sure you've read the handbook and make sure you've set things up in school properly so that this program can be delivered well for everyone.
I think that would be music to Mark's ears there. Make sure you read the handbook.
the much maligned.
Well, I mean, almost every question that we field, the answer is in the handbook.
Oh,
and I totally get it. And we don't mind fielding it because people are really busy. And if you've got 10 minutes between lesson one and lesson two and you can't find which page it's on, it's quicker to phone someone or ping off an email. I totally get that. But often people don't even know that it is in the handbook and that they could be looking in there. And that's frustrating. And I think for people that are just starting out with the early career framework, making sure that you've set things up in school properly will make the whole year or 2 years better for everyone.
That's great. And we know that schools are time-pressed places. And I can hear the bell ringing, which is, I'm afraid, going to have to bring our conversation to a close. Stephanie, I know that Elaine and I could talk to you all afternoon.
Thank you.
And bask in your superior wisdom. but we have to draw it to a close. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, Stephanie. It's always an absolute delight. I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening. Maybe you have a second cup of coffee when you go. Maybe we didn't even ask you for your biscuit of choice. Maybe that's an important thing today. It's a part of a tradition of our podcast. What's your biscuit choice, Stephanie? You can munch that on your way out of the staff room.
Well, if there's nothing homemade, then my biscuit choice is a custard cream.
Can't go far wrong.
I think simple, but I would say elegant and classic, really, a custard cream.
As if you've described our guest.
That's so smooth. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. Please do get in touch with us if you think you would like to chat about your ECF experience. In the meantime, do join us next time for a biscuit and a chat with another colleague in the ECF staff room.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.